Here's to the crazy ones, the misfits, the rebels, the troublemakers, the round pegs in the square holes.
You're listening to the Innovators Podcast with Tom Kennedy, unpacking the stories of industry leaders in search of the tools, tips, and tricks that make them who they are today.
Hi, and welcome to episode 4 of The Innovators. In this episode, I'm going to be sitting down with Professor Timothy Noakes, who many of you are probably familiar with, but he's a scientist and an emeritus professor in the Division of Exercise Science and Sports Medicine at UCT. Sure, got that out first time. This is a really in-depth and awesome chat I had with the professor himself. We go through a whole bunch of stuff covering nutrition, his story, how he got where he is today, the struggles, the legal battles, as well as the sort of growth of the low-carb, high-fat diet and how it can impact your life in general. We also cover diabetes and how it's a huge burden on governments around the world, their ways that you can improve your own life, look at what you eat on a daily basis, and a whole bunch of stuff. It's really a super in-depth and awesome discussion we had. The show notes alone are 3 pages, and you can see them all on at theinnovators.co, along with all other relevant info, links, and sort of feature mentions during the discussion. If you want to get in touch with me, see what goes on behind the scenes, or just have a chat in general, I'm available on pretty much every social network at T Kennedy SA, and I'm always open to feedback and suggestions, so give me a shout. I think what's best is that I just hop straight in. This is a really great episode. I hope you guys enjoyed as much as I did. This is Professor Timothy Noakes on The Innovators. Cheers. Intro. How do you describe what you do and who you are? It's always best to hear from the horse's mouth.
Well, I think I'm so many different things, Tom. So I went to school in Cape Town, and when I matriculated, I had no idea what I wanted to do. Fortunately, I went to America on an American exchange program scholarship and landed up in Los Angeles, California for a year, and it was just the most amazing year of my life. And during that time, Professor Chris Barnard performed the world's first human heart transplant, which happens to be 50 years ago in December the 3rd this year.
Very true.
So it's the 50th anniversary of that. And 3 months later, in March 1968, I woke up one morning saying, you must study medicine. And I always listen to my brain. So I applied to UCT and fortunately was accepted. And when I got into UCT and started studying medicine, I realized I was much more interested in the sort of normal physiology and health rather than disease. And so when I finished my training and did my internship, I was realizing I wanted to get into science. So I went straight into science, did my doctorate, PhD in medicine, and then started sports science, teaching sports science at UCT. And from there, I became a sports scientist for the most of my career. And then more recently, I suddenly fell into this diet and nutrition story over the last 5 years. So during that time, I challenged 7 different beliefs and managed to prove them all wrong. And that's kind of why I'm thought of as an innovator. Okay. And I don't know where it comes from. I just see something and feel it's wrong, research it a bit. Then I see the evidence. There's a lot of evidence that it is wrong. And then I go for it completely.
What I like about you also is you're very willing to admit when you've actually been a proponent of that the wrong sort of thinking. I know in The Law of Running and a few books, you've actually brought it up on slides and sort of showcased it almost. You were a proponent of a high-carb diet originally back in the day.
Yeah, that's great.
That ability to sort of look at what you've done incorrectly and then almost look back, like what were the signs that sort of showed you maybe – let's maybe talk about your own personal journey with the high-carb diets and stuff like that.
It's pretty easy, you see, because when I came into medicine in 1969, people had just started talking about carbohydrates and exercise. Up to 1969, the athletes had normal diets, which were higher in protein and fat. Carbohydrates were considered the poor man's diet. I mean, that was the way it was. And then things changed. And firstly, a group of scientists in Stockholm decided that if you filled your muscles with sugar, carbohydrates, that you would perform better. And that then just took off. They had limited evidence for it, but we became all engrossed and believed it. And then, of course, industry started funding us. So I was funded by the sugar and the carbohydrate industry to do more studies to prove even more that a high carbohydrate diet is beneficial. So, of course, that's what we did.
Yeah.
What happened to me was that my father died of type 2 diabetes, and I saw him die in the most, it's the worst disease you can possibly have. And he was fed a high carbohydrate diet on the basis that diabetics need lots of carbohydrate. And I never thought twice about it because it was so ingrained in that theory. Anyway, on the 12th of December, 2010, so I can tell you the date, that's why it was so interesting.
I actually have it written down here as well. Yeah.
I had just finished writing another book called Waterlogged, which attacked the company called Gatorade, which produced a product, a sports drink, which we'd shown the way they were marketing it was damaging people's health because they were over-promoting the product. People were over-drinking and, as a consequence, running into trouble. And that made me realize that how industry works. Industry works through the scientists. And the scientists then, they control the scientists who then draw up the guidelines for you and me as the general public. And we have no idea because these are the scientists. They do all the publications. Who's the expert in carbohydrates during exercise? Oh, it's this guy. And he wrote these guidelines. My gosh, they must be true. The analogy is diabetes. You know, who's the expert in diabetes? Oh, they're the people who travel the world talking about insulin therapy. And they're funded by industry and they've got all these publications and their names are on the, they drew up the guidelines. And then you say, but hold on, who benefits from those guidelines? It's the manufacturers of the products, be it Gatorade or insulin. And no one asked that question.
I mean, the statin industry, I think, is something like a $35 billion industry. I mean, that's just one tiny little treatment of a certain thing. So
absolutely.
There's definitely, I think you've even used the term, what's it, follow the money at the end of the day. It's because there is this strange, even now you're seeing almost a big pushback. There's a lot of well-funded vegan, very like sort of documentaries coming out that are sort of trying to push back against this new sort of way of thinking.
Exactly.
So it seems like, this does definitely seems to be sort of ulterior motives.
You just got to worry who's behind the vegans.
Yeah.
That's the other issues. Yeah. There's always money behind all of it. Yeah.
Exactly. I read online that it's being pushed almost as a religion, and there's a lot of well-funded organizations sort of pushing and that's why I've seen a huge uplift in talk of the vegan lifestyle, online.
Sure.
So you also said it's almost like I think you've used the term lipophobia. There was pushing of this fear of fats and eat as little as possible and eat as many carbs as possible, which now to me, and I think to a lot of South Africans because of yourself, seems so absurd.
Yeah.
But globally, why do you think it's been so slow to be adopted? Because there's still such major pushback, and I don't think it's taken off quite as strongly as in South Africa and in the Western world or in many countries. What do you think the reasoning is? Is it the same just pushback by lobbyists?
That's right. There's less of it in South Africa and it's less coordinated.
Okay.
So I'm reading a book at the moment called Smear, and it's written by Cheryl Atkinson. And she became interested as an investigative journalist in how do individuals become smeared and they're taken out of public life. And that happened to me, but they fortunately didn't win. And they didn't win for two reasons. The public didn't buy in. When you smear someone, what they do is they have public relations companies are geared. This is what they do. This is their business. As soon as a story comes out that could threaten a business, the business contacts the smear company, public relations, and then they attack the individual who wrote the report. So that's what happened to me. But unfortunately, the public believed me. And they said, you can only win a smear if the public agrees with you. It has to be really possible. And so I survived that smear, but it's very clear how it happens. And I think what happens in the other countries is that they're still too sophisticated. The smear artists are too clever, and they destroy individuals if you get up and stand up and do something. So, for example, if you got up and said that statins don't work in America, your career will be on the line. It's because they will attack you. The industry will make sure that you're taken out. And it's frightening. And actually, it's really interesting because the person who starts it is Hillary Clinton. She begins it in the 1990s. It's astonishing.
Oh, as First Lady?
Before she was First Lady, she wanted to be First Lady. And she knew her weakness was her husband's dalliance with many different women. So what she did was she developed smear attacks on all the women who attacked her husband, which is astonishing. You see, And anyway, the book really shows how she was the start of it all and how in the 2008 presidential election, she started targeting Obama, and but she didn't win on that one. And she had one or two things up her sleeve which just failed because she could have won the presidency on that. And then she attacked Trump. And so the book shows the way this is just continuing.
And it sounds like an interesting book.
It's a fabulous book. And this lady's life is in danger because she exposes, she says, well, this company does that, and this is where they get their funding, and this is the person who's doing it. It's a multi-billion dollar industry in the United States.
I can imagine. Yeah. There was, while I was doing research for you, sometimes I felt like I was going down this dark hole where there's a lot of some rather eccentric vegan types who have quite they're anti your position on diet.
Sure.
One of the things that comes up quite often is the fact that you yourself are diabetic. Mm. Can you maybe describe like how you would answer someone who's in, get the crazies who say,
of course,
he's a proponent of this diet, yet he's diabetic himself.
Absolutely.
What's your,
I just tell you the facts. You see, the facts are very simple. That firstly, my father died of diabetes, my uncle died of diabetes, and my second and another and an aunt died of diabetes. So we have the genes in diabetes, and they've gone through to my own children. I know that, you know, from various tests that we've done. So the genes, I come from with the worst possible diabetes genes that you can possibly have. Mm. I eat a high carbohydrate diet for 33 years and developed type 2 diabetes. I convert to this high fat diet. But I only make the diagnosis because I'm so ignorant. Like all doctors, I think that eating this diet is going to prevent everything. Eating this high carbohydrate diet and exercising. And remember, I ran 70 marathons or ultra marathons.
Yeah.
And I was physically active. That's point one. Point two, I have data on myself at the age of 28 when I was profoundly insulin resistant. And so that's my body. I inherited this insulin resistant body, and I would have been fine if I'd eaten a high-fat diet all my life. I wouldn't have got the disease. It was the high carbohydrates. Now, if you test me, I'm on medication. You couldn't diagnose that I'm diabetic, but I'm on medication. And so and if I had eaten the high carbohydrate diet for another 7 years, I would be 30 to 40 kilograms heavier. I would be on insulin. I would probably have had my first stroke or my first heart attack like my father did.
Yeah.
And I might have lost my limbs. Now, he died 10 years older than me. I am today. So I had the choice. Do I go the route of my father and die losing both my limbs, strokes, heart attacks, not being able to speak to me when he died? That's diabetes. And that what killed him wasn't the disease. It's the treatment. And that's what I've learned.
Okay.
So now I look pretty healthy. Not perfect, but pretty healthy. And if you tested me, you wouldn't be able to say that this man's diabetic. If you did conventional screening, you'd have to test more thoroughly. If I was on a high carbohydrate diet, it would be so apparent. It would be so obvious that I'm diabetic.
Okay. So do you believe if we adopt the sort of low carb, high fat diet from an earlier age, like hypothetically, do you think if you could off put entirely getting type 2 diabetes, or is that a potential option? Do you think it would have been non-existent in an ideal world?
That's a fantastic question, Tom. Thank you. When I graduated in medicine in 1974, Cape diabetes was not a major disease in the Western Cape. So 1974, in my own lifetime as a medical practitioner, diabetes was not prevalent. Today, Cape Town is probably the world capital. There's only another, there's an island, Nauru Island in the Pacific, which has the highest incidence. And that was because there was a population that had lived on coconut and fish all their lives. Americans came in, took all the guano because it was such a wealthy island. Everyone stopped working. In came the Coca-Cola and the industrial foods. And that population was decimated. Why? Because if you are living on a high-fat diet, you become insulin resistant over generations, over millennia. And that population can only eat high-fat diets, high-protein diets. If you give them carbohydrates, they will develop diabetes. Why in the Cape Town is diabetes so prevalent? Because the mixed community in this country, the mixed race community, appears to be at high risk of diabetes.
Oh, really?
There's a study that the Cape Technicon researchers did of 1,000 people in Bellville, and they tested them for markers of diabetes, and they essentially those 1,000 people who were not selected because they were sick are all going to get diabetes. People do not understand this magnitude. Yesterday, a paper published showing 100 million Americans of 300 million are already diabetic or pre-diabetic, and that's not even on proper testing.
Yeah, I read that stat, 29%, or is it even higher now?
It'll be up to 50% when you do proper testing.
Oh, yes, because there's a different type of testing they're doing. Exactly. Actually, I think I saw your talk you had on that.
Yeah. That's right. If you test for insulin rather than glucose, you'll find that there's a whole... So the first thing that goes wrong is insulin.
Crazy.
And you over-secrete insulin. And if you don't test for it, you won't detect it. If you only measure the glucose response in humans... People look like they're normal because they're over-secreting insulin and it's compensating. They're in a compensated. So you've got pre-diabetes and diabetes, but you've got another state which is compensated pre-diabetes.
Wow.
And that's going to be much bigger than both of those two groups.
Because I think you've also said that you believe diabetes could be one of the biggest issues for government, well, medical issues, even more so than, say, HIV or AIDS.
Much more. Wow. You know, there are 400 million people with diabetes already today. And there are 40 million with HIV.
That's true.
It's 10 times more. And we kind of ignore it. Why? Because it's a business. Because there is so much money being made from insulin that no one's going to address it. And you see, the trouble is, this is where industry controls. As I'm kind of led into this, why did I become an expert in carbohydrates? Because I was being funded by the industry. And so we were able to spend a couple of thousand rand a year on research, or tens of thousands of rand on research. So I got to travel and talk and meet all these people and get more money and do more research. Now, if you're a doctor and you're treating diabetes, the only way you'll become a world authority is by selling insulin. You have to be a marketer for insulin.
Okay.
Now, next week or 2 weeks time, very shortly, I'm off to California to Virta Health, which is a company that is reversing type 2 diabetes with this diet.
Oh, really?
And showing it, and it's astonishing. So they started with 250 patients, and they've now gone through the first year. They're actually up to a year and a half, but they've got data on the first year. And this is an intervention. You see, they realized you can't reverse diabetes the way we try. You see the patient every 3 months. Doesn't work. You have to see the patient every day. So how do you see the patient every day? Answers through the telemedicine or through the internet. And they set up
sort of like video conferencing type consultations. Oh, that's
exactly.
Amazing. Okay.
And you using your cell phone. So you have to download 3 glucose tests every day. You have to download the food that you eat each day. And in exchange, you get doctors to look at what you've eaten. They check your glucose. So, for example, one of the problems in this diet is that you don't need to use insulin. But you've got to get the people off the insulin. And it's quite dangerous putting people on this diet if they're still taking insulin. They have to be weaned of the insulin. So they have to report back to the doctors every day. And because the minute you stop taking carbohydrates, your insulin requirement drops dramatically.
Okay.
And what they've shown, that 97% of their patients after 1 year are off insulin or greatly reduce the dosages.
That's amazing. And then is that a permanent fix? Do they not really have the data to see forward yet?
That's a brilliant question. And the answer is, as long as you stay on the diet, you're fine. But you slip back.
So it recurs quite quickly.
Absolutely. Because the people are in remission. They're not cured. That's a great point.
Okay.
And I think we need to stress that point. They are not cured. They're in remission. And they're only in remission if they eat 25 grams of carbohydrate a day.
Actually gives me goosebumps. It's quite a big – that's a huge deal for a lot of people. They're giving them the idea that they can just make a lifestyle change and get rid of a disease that's
pretty
debilitating in the long
term. No, it is. It's terribly debilitating. And you see, this makes the point that it's not the disease that's the problem. It's the treatment. The treatment is killing people. And so that's why diabetes was so uncommon, because we weren't eating carbohydrates to the same extent. See, humans have no capacity to eat a lot of carbohydrates. Our evolutionary history is that we've eaten a high-fat, high-protein diet for 2 million years at least. And now we suddenly changed in the last 50 years. And we're the only mammals on Earth who eat high-carbohydrate diets. So people immediately say, no, you're mad. What about the cows? The cows are eating cellulose. They're eating a high-carbohydrate diet, you see. So the thing about the cow is that it's just this amazing animal.
It has four stomachs.
Got four stomachs, and it's got all these anaerobic bacteria, which convert the cellulose into saturated fatty acids. So what this animal eats is a high-fat diet. And people don't even understand, where does the protein come? If you're a meat eater, where does the protein come? It comes from the dead bodies of the bacteria themselves.
Really?
Which are incorporated by this fantastic animal, this ruminant cow, which converts this into saturated fat and protein.
Okay, well, you've just, I've had no clue, no idea about that whatsoever. Yeah, so that's exactly. Very interesting.
Okay. No, exactly. And so, and you see, we were like that too. We come from apes, primates, who also had this enormous gut. And that gut was full of bacteria, which is a fat-generating organ.
Okay.
So that's why if you see a gorilla, it's got this huge tummy. It's got this, because that's where it's generating its fat. What we learned was people got clever. They said, but this poor gorilla has to eat 14, 16 hours a day to generate enough fat to survive. Okay. Why don't we just eat the animals, the ruminants, the antelope? Because then we get our fat without having to produce it ourselves. As a consequence, we lost our gut. The gut shortened, the large colon shortened dramatically, and we have a carnivorous diet. Now, I mean, so we have a carnivorous gut, just like the lions. We have a very short colon.
Okay.
And so that's why we moved towards the high-fat, high-protein diet.
So what do you think? Well, like, I'm trying to get back to this. So now it's almost parrot talk with certain doctors, yeah. And it's that eat less, exercise more, and don't eat fat. That was the go-to.
Yeah.
What was that because of? Forgive me if I'm incorrect here. It's glycogen, glucose. Our muscles store a lot. Our brain operates on, is it one or the other? I know they're the same thing hypothetically, or there's some difference. I'm not too clued up. But is that why we had this idea that we need carbs? Because it's easier to convert. Like, where did this originate from? Like,
okay, it originates in the 1950s when there's one gentleman, one man, Ansel Keys in America. He's a physiologist. He's not actually a medical doctor. He just became famous in the Second World War because he developed the K rations, which were the Keys rations for the American fighting forces. Now, up to the Second World War, the food for fighting forces was a thing called pemmican. Pemmican is a high-fat, high-protein block of food, which was developed by the Plains Indians because they just ate bison. And the bison didn't always come back, so they had to have some reserve foods, and they developed pemmican, which they could store. It can live for 20 years.
Is it almost like a spam can?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like that. Okay, cool.
And it's completely indestructible. All the trips to Antarctica and the Arctic were done on pemmican. The whole north, the Canadian north was opened up by pemmican. That was the fur trade. And there were wars on pemmican because the traders had to have pemmican to go north. And so who controlled the pemmican controlled the industry.
Oh, wow.
There were two pemmican wars. So
that's amazing.
Now Keyes went to his shop, his local shop, and he saw all this industrial food. And then he said, oh, well, that's what they can eat. It was astonishing. There was no science behind it.
Really?
The next thing that happens is Eisenhower, who's the president, has a heart attack. And Keyes is called in to give him advice on diet. So he puts him on a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet. What happens to Eisenhower is what happens to everyone on that diet. They get hungry. So he put on weight. And eventually he was starving. His cholesterol went up and he had 6 heart attacks. So this is one of the basis for Keyes' experiment is that he kills Ansel Keyes. But then he publishes a paper and becomes very famous for what's called the 7 countries study, which was completely biased. He took countries with low heart disease rates, whom he knew didn't eat fat, and countries who had high heart attack rates.
I'm familiar with this.
And he chose 7 countries of 22. And it works out that if he had chosen any other combination, he wouldn't have got the result.
Okay.
So there's even a question that he had worked out beforehand, the 7 countries that he
some of those choosing the data to
absolutely.
Prove your hypothesis.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Exactly right. And he then got the American Heart Association on board. So in 1959, he spoke before the American Heart Association. And they said, Keyes, this is junk science. You've got no evidence. It's all association. You can't assume cause from association like that. And within 2 years, he had converted the American Heart Association. How? Because he put himself on the committee and his friends on the committee. Nice. And the American Heart Association has been bought into that. Next thing that happened, they got funding from the vegetable oil industry. And the vegetable oils are the polyunsaturated vegetable oils, which are highly toxic for us. And which we're told to replace saturated fat with these polyunsaturated vegetable oils, which are highly toxic. And Keyes did a study in the 1970s, one of the best nutrition interventions ever, called the Minnesota Coronary Experiment, where they fed a group of people who were inmates in hospitals. They fed them this, the high polyunsaturated fat diet, and they did worse. The people over 65 did worse on that diet. He Wow. buried the data. The data were rediscovered 2 years ago, and they were reanalyzed, and they said, but here you are. If he'd published that data in 1974, the high carbohydrate diet would never have been accepted because he had disproved it.
And now it's just so ingrained in this. It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's and so hard. Some people just refuse to, their mind almost can't sort of make that correlation between like the new, you can actually eat fat. It's so ingrained from such a young age.
Well, that is a smear effect. That is the smear on saturated fats. That's what they managed to do to it. And even who stood up against it was smeared. So that was it was probably one of the first smears that happened.
Down back in the early days.
And the thing about the smear campaigns is you never question where it came from because it's so obvious that obviously it's true, but you never question it. So that's what happened. So then the American Heart Association bought in and they said, we must stop eating fat. And so we must replace it with carbohydrates. But then they said, they didn't understand that if you take fat out of food, it tastes like nothing. And then they had to, so what the industry discovered was if you put sugar in food, people would become addicted to it. And then we've got this addictive eating behavior, which is causing the obesity diabetes epidemic. People are always hungry. So obesity is a disease of hunger. And we're trying to make it a biological disease, et cetera. But it's purely because the brain's been overstimulated by sugar and carbohydrates, and it continues to eat. So you put on weight. And then because of the insulin resistance, which is the other component, you then develop type 2 diabetes.
Wow, yeah. It's almost like a domino effect that sort of started so far back.
Exactly.
I'm interested in, so a lot of, at the moment, there's a lot of talk around ketosis. It plays a large role in the low carb, high fat diet. What's actually, could you maybe explain ketosis and why there's so much interest in what's occurring when your body's releasing ketones and the sort of things that are happening within us? So
great. So humans are, you can be one of two ways you metabolize. You're either a carbohydrate burner. So if you eat a lot of carbohydrate, you're always over-secreting this hormone insulin, and insulin has certain effects. Because we're not adapted to carbohydrates, we actually have great difficulty getting rid of the carbohydrates. So in our bloodstream, for example, we have only 5 grams of glucose, which is two teaspoonfuls of sugar. Now, every morning in Cape Town, the majority of children get up and they eat 200 grams of carbohydrate. So you've got 200 grams of carbohydrate. It's got to find its way into a bloodstream that can only accommodate 5 grams. And this is a major crisis because humans are simply not designed to do that. And so we've got this hormone insulin, which we over-secrete to try and get rid of the carbohydrates. And the best way we get rid of them is to burn them. So the instant you eat a high carbohydrate diet, you immediately start to burn carbohydrates. So insulin's main effect is to turn off fat metabolism.
Okay.
And so you inhibit all fat mobilization in the body. Your fat stays in the fat cells. It doesn't come out to be used as a fuel. And you just burn the carbohydrate. Now, 3 hours later, that kid who's eaten his 200 grams for breakfast is now hungry because it's tea time. So now he has something else. He has a cookie or a muffin. More carbohydrates, more insulin. So that child goes through the day just burning carbohydrate. And that is the majority of Cape Townians or South Africans are living that way. They're burning carbohydrate all the time and they're not accessing their fat. What happens when you stop eating carbohydrates is your insulin levels drop immediately. And then you start to mobilize fat from your fat cells. So the fat starts to circulate. And one of the consequences in the liver is the liver starts to produce things called ketone bodies. And ketone bodies are probably this kind of super fuel because they're used by the brain in a great amounts, and that they can completely substitute for most of the carbohydrate that you need.
And they're also very good for the heart, are they not?
Absolutely. The heart will burn ketones. And it's really funny because that was the first experiments I ever did for my PhD was feeding ketones to hearts to show how well they worked.
Oh, okay.
And they do more
using androgenous ketones
we were studying rat hearts. So they were isolated from the animal and so on. and we were using exogenous carbon because it's also, see, ketones are miraculous.
Oh, wait, exogenous. I've just said androgynous.
So. Yeah, that's right. You meant exogenous.
Exogenous, yeah. Sorry.
So, and the beauty of ketones is they're water soluble. You see, most fats are not. They've got to be carried in a with a protein surrounding them. But ketones are fat soluble, and then they cross the brain barrier, the blood-brain barrier, and our children build their brains from ketones, and that's was part of the trial against me was people didn't understand it. The dietitians who attacked me had no clue why you use ketones for the brain function and for actually building brains.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
I'm a Google scientist over here. I don't know the exact, but there's two. There's acetone,
And beta-hydroxybutyrate. Yeah.
So that's what's being, what are these now doing? They're allowing the body to change.
The key problem, you see, is your brain does have a fundamental need for glucose. There are certain cells in the brain which are so tiny, the nerve endings, they're so tiny that they can't pack mitochondria. And mitochondria, you burn glucose or you burn fats in the mitochondria. And these cells are so, or these parts of the neuron, the axons, are so tiny that they can't pack mitochondria. So they have to burn glucose, because you can burn glucose to lactate without requiring these heavy protein structures, which are mitochondria, which where we normally convert fat to energy.
Okay.
So they use glucose to lactate. And you need about 25 grams a day, or about like a gram an hour, to keep those cells functioning. A gram of glucose. But the liver can easily produce that gram of glucose very easily. On a high carbohydrate diet, your liver won't be producing all that amount of glucose, because it's all coming in from the diet. Okay. The moment you stop taking in carbohydrate, the liver now must upregulate and start producing a bit more glucose. And during that phase, the ketone bodies are used by the brain, because they're almost like glucose. They can be used as a fuel. So that's what happens. And so your brain normally requires 125 grams of glucose a day. It'll come right down to 25 grams, because and the difference is made up from ketones. So that's why we're able to survive, because of ketones. Without ketones, we wouldn't survive.
I've got that written down here. Someone said, without ketones, our species wouldn't actually be here.
Precisely.
Today. Because there are a lot of people that create the sort of analogy to caveman days, where you'd have to hunt and there'd be long periods of time without eating. So the body would then start looking to.
And then people don't understand that in the last million years, 90% of the last million years has been an ice age. No one tells us that, because we look outside and we've got problems with climate change and heating. But we're a population that's designed to live in cold, by and large.
Yeah.
And when it's cold,
body burns more energy.
But how many carbohydrates can you grow on the land?
Oh, very true. Yeah.
And so humans were the best killers of massive animals, because it turns out that the massive animals are the most energy replete, because they have so much fat in them. And there are reasons why you have to eat fat, and we won't go down that route. But you had to find animals with lots of fat. And we really ran into trouble when we'd killed off all the elephants and the mammoths, because then we had to do something else. And so we started agriculture, in my opinion. Agriculture now provided the carbohydrates, because we weren't getting enough fat. So very briefly, you can only take 35% of your calories every day from protein. If you do more, you'll kill yourself, because you can't detoxify. Humans can't detoxify more than 35% of the diet from protein. So you have to fill the other 65% from carbohydrates and fats. Now, if you're living in the Arctic and you're killing mammoths, that's fine, because they have more than 65% of their bodies are fat. So you can get lots of protein, but you also get lots of fat. In Africa, it's difficult. Zebras are about 65%. And there are some other animals, rhinoceroses and hippopotamus and elephants. They're the only animals that have got so much fat on them that they'll provide you with your 65%. If you're not getting that, you have to have carbohydrates. Okay. And we went towards carbohydrates as we got and fat animals started to die off. And in Africa, there were less of these huge fat animals.
Okay, so it was almost a need, not really a requirement.
Exactly right. And it was because then the populations got too big. And then once we started eating carbohydrates, the populations just exploded.
Okay, so there's also there's quite a lot of different ways of kicking your body into ketosis. Yeah, so some people are doing prolonged fasting, like the Tim Ferriss's, and getting your body into a ketonic state, then beginning a long period of fast. Because apparently, also that's why you can then fast for a longer period of time, because your body is now. But there's also exogenous ketones. Are you a proponent of sort of supplementing with them, and then also just the diet approach? So making sure you eat 25 to 30 grams.
That's correct.
Maximum. What are your different takes on different approaches? Intermittent fasting, prolonged fasting. I'm just curious what you think of those different sort of approaches.
Well, you know, we've known for a long time that the less you eat, the longer you live. Within reason. Obviously, you can't starve. And that is so well established in animal models. If you underfeed animals, they live longer. Oh, wow. And so there's growing interest in fasting. And I think that that's a natural human state, is to fast. And to eat once a day, maybe once every second day. But we've converted that to eating 5 or 6 times a day, which is completely wrong.
Okay.
So I personally, because I'm diabetic, I fast as much as I can. So I'll eat one meal a day maximum, and then I might snack on high-fat diets. But I've got down to eating one meal a day. And so I fast from evening till lunchtime most days. I mean, there are some days I don't. But so I'll eat for 8 hours a day and fast for 16 hours a day. But again, I emphasize I am diabetic. And that's one of the best ways to help manage it.
Because even doing the 16-hour thing, it's not that hard. If you eat your first meal at 12 midday and then you stop eating at 8 p.m., you're essentially doing a 16-hour fast every day.
Exactly right. And if from the evidence I have, you want to keep your insulin down. That's the key to long-term health, because insulin is a driver of aging. It's a driver of heart disease. It's a driver of cancer. It's a driver of dementia. There's no question that insulin's the problem.
Okay.
So keep your insulin down and you do much better.
That's interesting.
So that's the focus. So we promote the idea of fasting. Yeah.
One other thing that it's brought up, and I mean, it's also common sense, is there's no one size fits all solution for everyone.
Yeah.
For me, for example, I can maintain a single digit fat percentage, but I can eat very poorly a high. I shouldn't, but I can go through periods where I can carbo load, or I can eat a lot of carbs. Different people metabolize differently. Is that what makes finding a sort of consensus so difficult? Is it just because you've always got someone who will pipe up and go, oh, well, I do this and it works for me?
Yeah.
I guess that's, we all so different at the end of the day. So
you're quite right. But only 10% of the population are like you, I think, who can maintain a normal body weight on a high carbohydrate diet. You are the exception.
Okay.
You're not the rule. The rule is
definitely
me.
I think I know that as well. A lot of my friends know that as well. They'll look at me and say, how do you manage to maintain the way? And girlfriends and people get quite annoyed with me.
And we wouldn't know why you're lean, so thin. You know, and I would say it's because, you see, what you've got is you've got perfect balance between your energy intake and energy expenditure at this low body fat content. And you're not hungry.
Yeah.
Those are the keys.
Okay.
So your brain is very, very astute in keeping you not hungry, even though you're eating few calories. You have to be eating few calories.
Because that's just, it's science.
You couldn't be as lean as you are eating a lot of calories. Because would break many rules of thermodynamics. You have to be eating little, but you're not hungry.
Okay.
And that is a very unusual combination.
Also, most
people, they're either genetically like that or they're enforced, like me, eating a high fat diet. That's the only way you can be lean and not hungry. Either your genetics and you can cope with the carbs without it stimulating you to be hungry, or you're eating a high fat diet.
Very interesting. I find people are very militant about their diet almost to a degree. Well, you get a lot of people like this vegan thing is driving me a bit crazy online at the moment. They're very militant, very aggressive, they'll fall back to certain arguments such as we're saving the world, it's better.
Like, which they aren't.
Yeah.
Actually, veganism destroys the culture much quicker than eating animals, much quicker. They just don't understand it. You see, they think that because they look at their plate and there's nothing, no dead animals, they don't see the dead animals that soy caused. So when they go and have to grow more soy in the Amazon. What do? They destroy the land. They kill all the animals on the land. Where you're growing soy or wheat or maize, it's absolutely sterile. The land is absolutely sterile. There's not an animal living there. There's not bacteria living in the soil. What happened to them? They all had to be killed. That's okay. Point one. Secondly, what that has caused is a complete destruction of the topsoil. And when you destroy the topsoil, then your society dies. All great civilizations die when the topsoil goes. When you put animals on the land, they increase the topsoil, and that retains carbon. So if you were to replace half of where they grow all their soy and wheat with cattle roaming on the land freely, they would sequester more carbon into the soil than has caused all the global warming. And they do it in 10 or 20 years. So you could reverse all the CO2 that's in the atmosphere by using animals to do it. And no one tells you
that. It's interesting. Yeah. But I think because there's been such a sort of unification of this vegan movement, now a lot of pushback from the other side. Yeah. So we're seeing a lot of people releasing sort of debunking. Yeah. I mean, there was a video that went viral debunking What the Health, and there's a lot of stuff like that. So now it's almost that the energy sort of has an equal and opposing force. As one movement starts getting louder and more vocal, the opposing side also gets louder and more vocal.
But you have to ask who's funding the vegan movement, and it's the fossil fuel industry.
Oh, really?
Yeah, absolutely. How do you grow wheat?
Nitrogen, like fertilizers.
Exactly. Where does the fertilizer come from? Point one. Okay. Point two, how much petrol is used to harvest all that stuff? That's the second one. Thirdly, they are causing global warming.
But they'll say that it's the emissions of cows farting.
Of course. Yeah. Which got nothing to do with it. And how do we know it had nothing to do with it? Because America in the 1800s had 60 million bison and 100 million pronghorn antelope grazing across America. Today, they have 40 million cattle, which are now causing global warming. Okay, so what happened to the 60 million bison and the 100 million pronghorns? Why didn't they cause global warming? Because they don't cause the global warming. It's the fossil fuels that cause global warming. And fossil fuels are central to the production of wheat and maize and soy.
Okay. See, I'm a personal proponent of, if you believe in a certain way of eating, go for it. Just don't become so sort of militant and there's like this religious fervor attached to being a vegan at the moment.
You need to read a book called by Leary Keith, and it's called The Vegetarian Myth. And she was a vegetarian she was a vegan for 20 years, and it destroyed her health. And she said she can never get her health back. And she said she continued to eat the diet because it defined who she was. And that's the key. Vegans and vegetarians, being that way defines who they are. And they can't drop that persona. It's incredibly difficult for them. And she describes how difficult it is. So although she was getting sicker and sicker and sicker, she wouldn't change until one day she decided she had to change. But, you know, I'll tell you the problem in the Western Cape is, the middle management in the Department of Health is influenced by vegans and vegetarians. So they're not going to change the diet of the people in Cape Town and say you must eat more fat and more protein from animal sources, because they say it's unsustainable. So we must just let people die from diabetes, because there's another agenda there. It's absolutely frightening.
That's what I think is most frightening about some of the pseudoscience spouted in a lot of these by vegans and the documentaries, the articles. Some of it is actually dangerous to... Yeah.
Well, just to let you know that Nina Teichholz, who was one of the expert witnesses in my trial and who wrote the book Big Fat Surprise, which completely destroys the story that fat causes heart disease. It's one of the great books in medicine of all time. It's a brilliant book.
I'll also mark that down in the show notes. Then.
Please. And she went and tweeted 2 days ago. She looked at that film. She looked at all the scientific claims. She said 93% of the scientific claims were wrong. There was only 6% which were supported.
There's been a lot of pushback against that. Yeah.
However, when the guy goes and talks to the American Diabetes Association and he asks the guy, tell me about diet. The guy says, diet's got nothing to do with diabetes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there's one clip in that movie, which is brilliant because it exposes the American Diabetes Association. And then he said, you see, veganism can reverse diabetes. And it's true. You know, there are two diets that you can use to reverse diabetes. You either follow the high fat diet or you eat no fat at all. And that is helpful. But very few people will lose weight on that diet because they just get hungry. They're always hungry and they may be sick. But it's the reality is you can improve your glucose control eating no fat. But I don't think it's anywhere near as effective as eating a high-fat diet. And for most people, that's a very difficult diet to follow. You know, in America, like there's 1.5% of the population are vegetarian. You're never going to get more than a tiny, tiny proportion of the population eating vegetarian.
Is it really that small?
It is.
I think it's just such a vocal 1.5%.
Absolutely. And the vegans are about 0.5%. And vegetarians only survive for about 2 years, and then they change. So the population is changing all the time, and it's a young population by the age of 35.
Yeah, there's a lot of worry at the moment online about the current vegan movement. It's starting to get very young. There's a lot of millennials and also people still in their developmental stages, which people are saying could be very negative for
you. The problem for veganism is where you're going to get your fats from, and the healthy fats come from animals. Apart from coconut and avocado, those are great sources of fat. But otherwise, you eat vegetable oils, the polyunsaturated industrial vegetable oils. Vegans really can't find it very difficult without those vegetable oils.
Isn't there also a need to supplement with vitamin B?
And B12 and so on.
B12, yeah.
And we're only beginning to realize what you're missing when you don't eat animal protein.
Okay. I'm also I'm going to segue off to a different – you brought up the case that you've had against you and maybe if you could just give some background on that. I know it originated from a tweet. And then you also brought up something quite interesting in a talk I saw of yours with the we versus I question.
That's quite
interesting.
Yeah.
Would you like to maybe just give some background on what happened there and how it turned into such a big ordeal for you?
So the problem begins when I wrote a book called Challenging Beliefs, and I talked about Ansel Keys, and I said cholesterol doesn't cause heart disease.
Yeah.
And then some cardiologist at the University of Cape Town at Critical Care Hospitals wrote a very damaging letter to the Cape Times saying that I was not allowed to express an opinion. So they laid the groundwork. Having done that, they said, now the smear against me could start, because here we had the professor of cardiology attacking me in the public domain. So that begins the smear. The next thing we do is we write the book, The Real Meal Revolution, which antagonized the dietitians right at the top in this country hugely. We now know that. And they became a mission to take me out. And they then became a part of the smear against me. And they were going to do whatever was possible to smear me.
So they were sort of searching for a smoking gun.
That's exactly what smear people do.
They look find for, that one thing that's,
Now, classically, one of the guys who smears me is from the University of Cape Town. And he listened to a lecture I gave and found one point where I made a mistake at 59 minutes in the talk. And that then became a smear against me. And so that's how they work. They look for everything. So now these people were trolling my Twitter. Then a lady asked a wee question, and it's something to do with, what should she be continue to eat a high-fat diet when she's weaning her child? And so I said something, and then I said, the key is to wean your baby onto LCHF, or to wean baby onto LCHF. Now, I was still answering a wee question. There's an article in the Huffington Medical Journal saying doctors should be encouraged to answer wee questions.
Okay.
But not I questions. So I answer this we question, which is perfectly all I'm doing is I'm giving information.
Well, is that because we can be seen as as a generalized population?
It's a generic question.
Okay.
See, the claim against me was I was in a doctor-patient relationship. As soon as you answer anything on Twitter, you become they wanted it to be we.
Oh.
The health professional council tried to force me into a doctor-patient relationship with this lady.
Okay, that's
and that then makes sense. Then medical rules apply, and then you've got to do X, Y, and Z, and they claimed I didn't do X, Y, and Z, and that I didn't examine the patient.
I was about to say, I'm probably going down that road.
Well, if you go down that road, you cross all the barriers in medicine. Because you'd have to ask for private information, which you can't.
And they really try to apply that to a Twitter, to a tweet.
They did that. Yeah. So, We've just finished, we've written a book about it, and I've just finished the epilogue, the final chapter. And the errors that were made were unbelievable, but the only reason they got away with it was because the scam was on, and they were trying to smear me at every possible opportunity. And the people who were involved were at the highest level.
Oh, wow.
And it gets so bad. It gets so bad that I'm charged on the basis of a scientific paper which supposedly proves that the low-carbohydrate diet is dangerous. We analyze the data. We find that it has 14 material errors where the data do not – what's presented, the information that's presented, does not correlate to what was in the original papers that has been quoted. 14 material errors.
Wow.
When you correct for those 14 material errors, it turns out that the low-carbohydrate diet outperforms the low-fat diet. Now, that information was used in a nationwide program by the Heart Foundation to prove that the diet's dangerous. You see, it's not better than our Heart Foundation diet. So therefore, it's worse, and therefore it's dangerous. Hold on. If they had reported that paper honestly, it would have shown that the low-carbohydrate diet was better. Imagine what would have happened if they had said that in 2014. At the time when the low-carb diet was taking off, they said, Dr. Noakes is right. The low-carb diet is better. We were wrong. Gosh, we're sorry. They didn't. They spun it the other way. And now no one will address it if it's fraud. We're not sure it's fraud or not.
Oh, is that where you think it's one of the things holding them back at the moment?
Yeah, they won't address it. We've asked the universities involved. There are three universities involved, Stellenbosch, Cape Town, and Liverpool. We said, aren't you going to investigate this? We've published this rebuttal. They haven't been able to answer these 14 questions. The 14 errors, they haven't been able to answer them. In fact, they've acknowledged that they made more errors.
Did the study not go through peer review or anything like that?
Of course it did, but who knows what? But peer review is the thing. It was a very long paper.
It took you going in over it with a sort of.
And the only reason we went over it was because we realized it had been so central to my charge. We don't think they could have charged me without that paper.
So you essentially took their gun and turned it on themselves.
Yeah, exactly. So that Claire Yulsing-Stratum, who's the lady who complained, who lodged the complaint, in testimony under oath, she said we were all waiting. All these big organizations were waiting for this paper. Why were they waiting for this paper? Who are these big organizations? Unfortunately, we never cross-examined her and asked her what were these big organizations. But that is on the text in the trial.
Amazing. So you've actually written a book about the whole...
We've written a book about it.
Oh, wow. And I didn't actually find that when I...
No, it's coming out in November.
Amazing.
But the smear will try to smear the book and say, read the book.
Yeah. But you were found innocent on all 10. There were 10.
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, amazing.
And we had to be because... And when you read the summary in the book, you'll see... At every place, they had people placed who were against me. See, for example, their first expert witness, when the tweet story was the complaint, I answered the complaint. They sent that response to the one person in South Africa who would be the most biased against me, a lady called Professor Esty Foster, who drew up the South African Dietary Guidelines. And what are the South African Dietary Guidelines? They say make starchy foods a feature of every meal. And they give it to her. What's she going to conclude? She wants to destroy me, so she tries to. But the beauty was when she... what I learned in my trial was five people saved my life.
Really?
There was my wife. There was Adam Pike, who was one of my lawyers. There was Marika Sporos, who helped me write the book. And there were two lawyers who gave their time for free.
They gave about
10 million rands worth to protect me for
That's
free.
That's amazing.
Dr. Rocky Ramdas from Pietermaritzburg. And Mike van der Nest, who's a senior counsel from Joburg, they got involved and they decided, you know, I was being scammed and I had to be protected. And Rocky is an unbelievable, because he's a medical doctor, he tore into this lady. So he said, so tell me, what qualifications do you have? What's your undergraduate degree? Oh, it's home economics. Oh, I see. So you don't have a training in dietetics, no? So what's your PhD? It's in something else. So you've never prescribed a diet in your life. You've never seen a patient. No. So tell me, what do you know about ethics? No, I don't know anything about ethics. You've got no training in ethics. And so tell me about Twitter and social media. What experience do you have? Social? I've known nothing about social media and I've not been on Twitter. So he said, well, why are you here? You've got no expertise. How are you expert witness for the prosecution? Because those were the things. It was the diet, the Twitter, and prescribing diets.
It's always nice when you've got a lawyer who's got a medical background who can come out to bat for you.
Yeah, exactly. But so then,
sounds like it's going to be a fascinating book. I'm very keen to check it out.
And it's the whole 5 years of what happened, because it starts 5 years ago with this letter from the cardiologist at Chris Cooper Hospital. And because that was the first inkling I had. And you know what was really interesting? And this is how the smears work. I had just been awarded the most important scientific award in South Africa called the National Research Foundation Lifetime Achievement Award.
Amazing.
And a very few people from my university had ever won it. So you'd expect the next day the university to be saying, gee, Tim Noakes won this award, you see. So what happens is I get the award, and within half an hour, my cell phone rings. And I answer it as a guy from the Cape Town saying, Dr. Noakes, we've got this letter from these cardiologists at Chris Cooper Hospital and University of Cape Town attacking you and saying that you're doing harm and you're damaging people and you're going to cause all sorts of harm. What do you think? So I hear, well, what did they say? So anyway, I respond to it. So the next day is Cape Times. It's not about Tim Noakes winning the awards. It's about he's damaging patients.
Yeah.
And because he's expressing an opinion that conflicts with what they've been teaching for the last 50 years. And then I realized we're onto something. There's something behind it. It's not about what it's about.
Okay. And how long off do you think we are until sort of the schools, the universities, like how far are we from this becoming sort of written into our guidelines and regulations and actually taught? Because I know you've released a lot of your research papers for doctors, because essentially if you can change one doctor's mind, you can change sort of a lot of people underneath
exactly
them.
Right.
Yeah. But how far do you think we are from it becoming the sort of status quo?
Well, what we did with the trial was we took it away from a trial of myself and my conduct to a trial of the diet. And that's why we had 12 days testimony.
Yeah.
12 days cross-examination.
I think you spoke yourself for 5 days.
That's right. That's correct. And I was cross-examined for 3.5 days.
Wow.
And they couldn't budge one thing.
I could imagine.
I made one tiny error in the whole debate. I made one tiny error.
Amazing.
Which was completely irrelevant. And we hoped that would sway the audience. And in her judgment, Joan Adams did say that what we had presented was logical and could not be described as unconventional. We were hoping that she would say, but I knew she couldn't, was he's proved that what we're teaching now is unconventional. But you see, but it's on record now. And the reality is that we prove that the dietary advice that is currently being given is unconventional because it's not evidence-based. And we showed that our evidence is evidence-based. So potentially, if a doctor tells you must eat a low-fat diet to prevent heart disease, you could report him to the Health Professional Council because that's unconventional advice. It's not evidence-based.
Oh, wow.
And a dietitian who said you must lose weight by eating a low-fat diet, we could also say that's unconventional advice. And you could report that patient personally.
That's quite a strange position for them to be in,
exactly,
I guess. Because
right.
They told one thing and taught one thing, and there's still this belief, but now they've...
So the Minister of Health could change it tomorrow. He could say, listen, I've seen the evidence. The evidence doesn't support what we're teaching in medical schools. You must change. He could change it.
And how far off do you think he is? Have you spoken to him?
Well, he's clearly not eating a Banting diet. So I don't think he, you know, what I learned in this trial is that government, industry, and academia are tied at the way hip. They are completely in cahoots.
I think you once also in one of your talks, you brought up the big Coca-Cola bottling plant and a few things like
exactly
that.
Exactly
right. There's a lot of money sort of backing industry.
There was pretty good evidence that Coca-Cola were behind some of the people driving, who were the key witnesses.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they were presidents of an organization called the International Life Sciences Institute, which is a Coca-Cola front organization. And that was proven by an investigative journalist who came to look at the trial.
Wow.
And he started
scratching around.
This is
all covered in the book.
Yeah, it's all covered in the book.
Sounds like it's going to be very exciting.
I
want to sort of go into some of, you get a lot of people who sort of hack their own diets and see what works for them. Are there any, I'm not trying to ask you to sort of give medical advice or anything, but like what sort of markers should people be looking for? Like what sort of signs are there that maybe you should be looking at a different diet? I personally test different things, see what works.
Yeah.
I'm very focused on sort of trying to improve cognitive function and seeing what makes my brain feel a little less misty or fuzzy. Yeah.
Well, that's easy. That's less carbs and more fat and ketosis. Ketosis is, if you want to really get clear thinking, just become ketotic.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of bulletproof coffee and a few things like that. I mean, I had it this morning. I'm just wondering, like,
so in my trial, I didn't eat breakfast and I starved the whole day, I fasted the whole day.
Oh, really?
So when I presented the evidence, because I knew that's the way I'll do it best.
You were just, so you're
I was ketotic the whole time. And it was a very funny point because Mike van der Neest, the senior counsel, was also on this diet. And that's why he looks so fantastic and why he's such a brilliant man. And at one stage, they said, we wanted to go on at night. And you see, they said, someone said something else. So Mike said, well, we're all ketotic. We can go all night without any food.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
It's nice when your entire defense team is operating on your the very basis of what you're trying to.
I'm going
to
answer your question very simply, and it's so simple. And you know the problem is people say no, it simplifies it. It can't be that simple. The answer is it's that simple. Firstly, if you're measuring your cholesterol, just please throw it away. Throw up your cholesterol because it means absolutely nothing to you.
Are you saying both mean nothing, LDL and HDL?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
They're absolutely hopeless predictors. They are useless predictors. Because firstly, the point is so few people are at risk of heart disease at our age or any age. The number of people dying from heart disease in the population is tiny.
You always see that graph where they say cardiac related illness is like the number
one
thing.
Absolutely. But you have to die from something, you see. And that's the difference. So it turns out that if you take 100,000 people at between age 35 and 45, 100 will die in the next 10 years from heart attacks. 100 in 100,000.
Wow.
But no one tells you that. Instead, you come to the doctor at 35. Oh, your cholesterol's 5.001. You're going to drop dead tomorrow from a heart attack. Hold on. Your possibility is 0.00001 of having a heart attack in the next 10 years. And you're told that this is, so 99.999 people will still be alive 10 years later, will not have had a heart attack. And that's how the scam has developed.
Why has it been such a strong folk? Where was the correlation between high cholesterol? Like where is this originally?
It was never shown. It's never been shown.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And I'll tell you, for example, the Framingham investigation is the one. If you ask a medical student that question, they'd say, oh, of course, doc, it was the Framingham study. What the Framingham study was set up in a little town outside Boston. They looked at about 5,000 people and they started following them for their risk factors. So they measured their cholesterol. It turned out that smoking predicts future heart attack risk. And initially they said they falsified it to say cholesterol does. When they came back 30 years later, they found that those people whose cholesterol were falling, had fallen, were at higher risk of heart disease and mortality from other diseases. And they said the healthiest people were the ones who were eating the most fat and doing the most exercise. And had the highest cholesterol. And they hid that. They hid that in data, which was hidden in somewhere in Washington, D.C. Someone had to find the information because it disproved so absolutely the story.
It's so sad this actually
currently,
happens.
Oh, yeah, currently in European countries, there's a large study of 40 countries, and there's another of 180 countries. The more fat in the diet, the less heart disease. The higher the cholesterol, the less heart disease in those populations. It's the countries that are eating the polyunsaturated fats that are dying from heart disease.
Wow. Yeah. So you were saying there, and then so tear up your
cholesterol test. It's not going to help you.
Discovery is not going to be happy to hear that.
Yeah, and that's a tragedy because the statin cholesterol low-fat diet caused the diabetes epidemic. By measuring your cholesterol, you're going one way. The doctor's going to say, because it's always going to be above 5 in most of us. So they're going to say, okay, you've got to go low-fat diet and take a statin. And that's the direction for diabetes. And they won't accept that responsibility. So that advice is causing the diabetes epidemic. So cholesterol throwaway. You need one measurement. The best measurement is your fasting insulin level at any age. But there's still another tip because the first thing that happens is your fasting insulin goes up. I have fasting insulin.
So insulin level, not the glucose fingerprint test that you do at the pharmacy.
No, you need fasting insulin.
Fasting insulin.
Because that's the first thing that goes up.
And how long, are we talking same, just don't eat, eat dinner and then have it in the morning without eating anything?
That's correct. Okay. And the value should be below 5 or 6.
Below 5 or 6.
Yeah. And my value when I was 28, running 140 Ks a week, running marathons, was 40.
Wow.
I was eating a high carbohydrate diet. It was 40. That is so profoundly insulin resistant. Had I known that, I said, okay, I'm diabetic. I might as well stop eating carbs. So that's the first thing. The second thing is your HbA1c, your glycated hemoglobin value. That tells you what your glucose, average glucose has been over the last 3 months. If it's 4.5, you are unbelievably lucky because you're carbohydrate sensitive and you can eat whatever you like, by and large.
I need to go do these tests, I think. I'm going to go take a look.
Exactly. And if you
just ask your doctor.
But the HbA1c is the first test.
HbA1c.
That's the best test. Because insulin, you know, you can still be 6 or 7 and say, okay, I'm
curious,
fine.
How does it become, how does it work out? How do you get a 3-month average? I'm curious.
Oh, because what happens is, when your glucose is elevated, it binds to certain proteins. And the protein in blood is hemoglobin. So the more glucose you have in the blood, the more hemoglobin gets bound to. And that gives you your glycated hemoglobin. And and red cells last about 3 months. So that'll give you an idea.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So,
now, if your value is 5.5, you are pre-diabetic and you're eating too much carbohydrate. If your value is 6.5, as mine was, you're diabetic. Now, the point is you don't go from 4.5 to 6.5 overnight. It takes decades, probably 20 years. So if you were to measure your HbA1c on a regular basis, if it's low every second or third year is all you need. But once it's 5.5, you need it every 6 months because it's going to go to 5.6, 5.7, 5.8. Then there's the answer.
Is that without a significant change in lifestyle or adopting a new diet?
That's because now you become more and more insulin resistant. That's one of the problems. If you're insulin resistant and you eat a high carbohydrate diet, you get progressively more insulin resistant. Wow. And that's why obesity is an age-related disease because you become more and more insulin resistant.
So this is something we should be trying to – that's a test we should be doing as early as possible in life.
Absolutely. You know, with children, you should be doing it at 5 or 6 or 7. And mothers would realize, oh, my gosh. My
I need to adjust his diet.
Yeah,
and
my kid's already insulin resistant.
Wow.
Yeah. The other way is just to measure your glucose on a regular basis after you've eaten, particularly after high carbohydrate meals. And I'll tell you how effective that is. Tim Cook, who's the CEO of Apple, are producing a glucose monitor through the wrist bracelet. And he started wearing it. So it must be very close to production or he wouldn't have been wearing it.
And I'm assuming how are they doing that? Through sweat or?
I don't know how they're doing it. They kind of, they put about 800 PhDs onto it and answered the question.
Because I know they use a lot
The point about my story is he suddenly lost 20 pounds. So people said, what happened? He said, my glucose was always high when I was eating carbohydrates. And I know the story about carbohydrates. You know, I should mention this, that Silicon Valley is low carbs. They are completely low carbs.
Oh, yeah, it's huge.
Yeah. And that's where the change is going to come. Yeah.
That's good. Yeah, you get the early adopters. You sort of
– exactly.
It's the whole Apple actual sales pitch used to be they would have the white headphones. You'd see all the funky kids wearing the white headphones, and then it slowly goes through into the mainstream.
You know, I gave a talk last night and a young medical student came up after us. She's a fourth year medical student. And she said, you know, we're not allowed to be taught what you're telling us. Yeah. And I said, I know that. And she said, we ask. And we said, no, we don't talk about that. That's the answer is we don't talk about it because there's no evidence. So I said, but there's a whole bunch of evidence. They're just too lazy to find it. And I told her, I said, you know, in 10 years time, the information you're getting, it will be of no value to you. Because medicine is going to change so dramatically.
Yeah, it's just exponential change happening.
And Google and Apple and so on, they're going to be controlling what happens in medicine.
That's very true, yeah, because they'll be controlling the flow of information at the end of the day.
Exactly. And my profession doesn't see it coming. We're just going to become irrelevant. Not for acute medical problems. We've still got a great role there. But for the average chronic conditions –
But I think also if you even look at computer vision and a few things like that, they've actually found that there was an algorithm written with a computer vision, well, a computer vision algorithm that can analyze moles and it can detect abnormalities at a far higher rate than a traditional doctor. Yeah. And those sort of advancements are going to become. Yeah. So I think a lot of diagnosis and some things are going to start falling into the realm of computer analysis and computer diagnosis. And then, like you said, specialists will step in to sort of.
Yeah. Eric Topol, who wrote the book, The Patient Will See You Now. The Patient Will See You Now. The opposite to The Doctor Will See You Now. And he said he carries on his cell phone the ability to diagnose heart attacks and even to look at your heart. So he said he's diagnosed heart attacks on the plane because it's so simple. He can decide whether the patient's pain is from a heart attack or not. And he can tell the plane whether they should go back or they can carry on. It's all there. That's just the scratching the surface technology.
Yeah, because some of the things with computer vision, even the cameras now that are sensitive enough to detect your heartbeat just from a prolonged distance because of this color changes in our skin. I mean, that's how the Apple Watch is essentially reading my heart rate is using the green LED to get the change in the blood cells moving through it. It's amazing, and it's just going to keep advancing and changing. I'm quite curious. I like to always break down lifestyles of the people who come on the podcast. So what does a traditional day actually look like for you? What sort of wellness techniques do you have? Do you meditate? Do you do any of those sorts of things?
Yeah, I meditate when I run. I mean, that's to me why, although that you can get the benefits from weightlifting and high intensity exercise that I get from running 45 minutes a day or so. You probably can get them in a much shorter time, but I meditate when I run. So that's where my meditation comes in. And I think running and being physically active has been one of the three components. The first one component is the running. The second one is the diet. I wish I'd known about this diet when I was 20. And third is an unbelievable marriage. I've got this wonderful wife. She's astonishing. And I mentioned the five people who pulled me through that trial.
Yeah, but she came up first.
She was number one. Because what these people do when they start to smear you, they isolate you from everyone. So that's what these people did at the University of Cape Town. They published this letter in the Cape Times and from the dean of the faculty. So therefore, that meant no one in the faculty could talk to me because I was now a pariah. And that meant I was isolated from the faculty. I was isolated from the Sports Science Institute. I was isolated from my own staff who I'd raised and helped. And the only person left is your wife. And if they can isolate you from your wife, they will.
And yeah, because some of those attacks can start getting quite personal. That's always the fallback. If stating your false science doesn't work or whatever then fall back to personal attacks, which is...
They never tried then the science because they knew they were lost on that. So they went the personal thing. Yeah, and, if my wife had vacillated ever and said, I think you're wrong, that would have been the end of it. Yeah.
That's amazing. So running's your go-to on a day.
Yeah.
Do you run every single day?
Well, as most days if I can. Obviously, some days I just don't feel like it or else I've got work and so on. Okay. But being retired is great because now I've got more time to run. My problem was when I first retired, I started running like I was a 15-year-old and I immediately fractured. I developed a fracture of one of the bones in my leg and I've never, ever had a fracture in my life.
You've actually just made me think of one other point I want to go back to. Inflammation in the body, there's a whole bunch of it's bad. It's something, but there's also been Dave Asprey was talking about nightshades and certain lectins and their impact on inflammation. What's the low carb high fat diets beneficial for inflammation, but what other sort of things can people adopt to limit? I know you get on the outskirts, you can do cold therapies and a whole bunch of things like that. But from a diet point of view, what are the best things?
Well, I think the first thing is what you don't eat. That's critical. And you've got to cut sugar. You may not have sugar. That's the first thing. And the second is cut processed foods. And thirdly is learn to cook and cook your own foods from real foods that you've sourced from farms in the area that are producing grass-fed animals. That would be the key. Okay. And where you're not getting exposed to pesticides and the agrochemicals like Roundup or glyphosate. You know, glyphosate is everywhere in the United States. I don't know to what extent it's in South Africa, but their breakfast cereals are just full of glyphosate. And many people think that that's causing as big a problem as the carbohydrates themselves.
Wow. So and what are the biomarkers for inflammation? If you were to test to see
how. Yeah, there are a couple. People normally say ultra-sensitive C-reactive protein, but I think it's kind of gross. There may be better ones like what we call tumor necrosing factors. There may be some of those. That's a difficult. I can tell when my body's inflamed. I start to get sore joints and sore.
Yeah, that's what I feel.
That's to me is a better marker, and I just don't feel quite as good.
I struggle a bit. I do a lot of trail running. I've also got a lot of some of the guys who came up. I was saying, does anyone have anything they would like to potentially ask you? And a lot of them are endurance athletes. I'm also going to be interviewing like Ryan Sands and James Lawrence, a few of those guys. Because I've got quite a strong interest in endurance sports. And after I run, especially trail, I like going up and down mountains and stuff like that. I sometimes do feel like I'm having joint issues and inflammation issues. So that's why it piques my interest to work out how I can adapt my
diet. You did indicate that you do eat more some processed food, some carbohydrates, and that's probably a major driver.
Yeah. Okay.
You need to keep the gut flora correct, and we don't yet know how you do that. But I think sugary processed foods are, and cereals, to me, cereals, particularly wheat, is a real problem because when I cut wheat, my health improved dramatically because I'm definitely wheat intolerant. But I had minor sniffles and things like that and headaches and migraines, which you never relate. And I used to get asthma occasionally and bronchitis. They all went as soon as I cut the wheat. And I know now how the wheat works. The wheat gives you this leaky gut syndrome and then you become inflamed. Wow. So I would look to the leaky gut as a key driver of inflammation.
Okay.
And for many of us, it's wheat derived.
I know Tim Ferriss has written a bit about leaky gut syndrome and gut flora.
It's huge, and it's only come out in the last 3 or 4 years. So,
because it's something like 10% of our weight or something is bacteria at the end of the day or something like that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And most of your feces are bacteria.
Yeah. I think we've covered pretty much most of the points. Is there anything else you'd like to share with the listeners or anything I haven't touched on?
Yeah, I'd just like to thank all those people who've supported me over the years because I wouldn't have come through if it hadn't been for the public support. And in the current situation of the world where you're getting all this fake news and fake information, you've got to be very cautious about what you believe. And the only way we're going to change things is to demand that we hear the truth. And that's what I tell students at the medical schools. I said, you've got to ask, are we being taught the truth? Or are we being taught a customized, industry-driven version of the truth? And we're only going to produce change through individuals working as groups. Do you know that there are 700,000 members of the Banting 7-Day Meal Plan Facebook page in Cape Town?
And so it's amazing. I think you've stated once there was 3 to 4 million people.
I think so. If we've got 700,000 people on one Facebook page,
it would make sense.
It makes sense that like 3 million people have adopted this diet. And you saw as we walked in here this morning, lady crossed the road
to come,
and she looked fantastic. She wasn't hugely obese. Mostly the people who come are still large.
Yeah.
And they say, Doc, I've lost 50 kilograms or I've lost whatever kilograms.
But I think part of the reason you had so much public support is it was so accessible. I've got both of your books actually in my bag. Yeah. The one I've got a 3-year-old son and it's the sort of diet you can adopt and it doesn't fundamentally change your entire life. And I think the changes in how you feel and the sort of positives people are drawing from changing their diets just speak volumes. So that's why I think people come to you. You've got these strong advocates who scream and shout support for you because it works at the end of the day for them.
And you see, they can't be suppressed. Whatever my profession tries to do, they can't suppress that. And eventually it will overwhelm them. And as we've said, that it's being driven by the Silicon Valley as well. And it can't stop it. So just time for my profession to jump on board. But in the meantime, it's thanks to the people that we've been able to produce the changes already that we have.
That's amazing. Well, yeah, I'm going to include all the links to the books. I mean, links to the books you've discussed and a whole bunch of the things we've covered in the show notes. There'll also be links to where you can read up more on Tim, on Professor Noakes and what he's been speaking about. And yeah, I hope to be buying your book shortly and reading more about the story. It sounds like it's going to be quite a riveting tale.
It is, you know, because so I started writing it like about 2 years ago because I was so frustrated with what was happening. And just to get it off my chest, because that's what I do. Once it's on the paper, then I can forget about it. And halfway through the trial, I suddenly realized that I had this gem, Marikos Boros, who's an investigative journalist. And she was writing about me, and she had not been supportive initially. Then she came along to our low-carb conference in Cape Town, and she met the 15 people who traveled all around the world to come to Cape Town to support me. And she said, oh, my gosh, these are really special people, and what they're saying is true. And she came on board, and she's the most brilliant writer. So that's she amazing. Covers the trial, all the evidence from the trial, and she takes these days of testimony and fillets out what's really important. And that's really made the book.
So is it structured as a story?
Yeah, it is. It's absolutely. Okay. So it begins with when I get attacked. So I begin by saying, here I went from being this world-class scientist to this complete idiot within 3 months. And how did it happen? Well, because I changed my mind, you see. And so then I go through all the people who attacked me. So just to warn those people who have written rude stuff about me, I they never think about it. I keep it. I kept it. And I stew on it. And then I said, okay, let's write about it. So when someone says, Tim Noakes says this and he's wrong, or Tim Noakes is an idiot and he's killing people, I said, actually, it's you killing people because this is what you're suggesting and here's the evidence. So it's heavily referenced. And then I put in 2 chapters on the science of the low-carb diet and the absence of science of the low-fat diet. And that's going to be built into a bigger book next year, which is going to be a complete book about the science of nutrition. So anyway, that's what I wrote.
Amazing, yeah.
And then so we go right through, and then she comes in with the trial. And then there's the epilogue, which she just finished yesterday, and it's spectacular because it just shows this thing should never, ever have happened in a rational society. It would never have happened.
Well, hopefully it'll take off to the same degree as the Real Meal Evolution and almost force some people to, and some organizations to reassess the way they're approaching things. Because I think we are at a point where regulation needs to change and people need to sort of wake up to a degree that there are new ways of approaching diet. And
So, you know, I wrote the book for that lady last night, young medical student. And I said to her, you know, I will give you a book. I'll put it in your hand. I'll say, just give this to the professors who say there's no evidence. She said, I know there's no evidence for what they're saying, but they refuse to see the other evidence. I said, well, there's the beginning of the evidence. Show them and ask them. Go to these papers and say, but what does that paper show? No, I've never read it. Well, why don't you read it?
Amazing.
Yeah.
And when is that going to be coming out?
November. Yeah, almost on the proof stages. The proofs will be coming out in the next few weeks.
Okay, awesome. I think we've pretty much covered everything we can. I hope you've enjoyed yourself discussing everything.
It's been a great interview, and thank you. And the reason it's a great interview is because you did your homework and you clearly know the story. So
yeah, I tried my best. I was sitting there. I've been going over for it for a while, and I was thinking, this is quite data, quite information heavy. I'm going to do my best to try and cover it all and make sure I don't make a fool of myself.
Thank you for covering everything I would have wanted you to ask.
Amazing. Yeah. I'm very privileged to have you on. And I hope you have an amazing time ahead. And the book, I'll be keeping an eye out for that most certainly.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Tom.
Perfect. And that's the end of that episode. I hope you guys enjoyed that as much as I did. I thoroughly enjoyed sitting down with the professor. I found it to be a hugely insightful episode myself. So if you have any ideas, suggestions, or just want to dig a bit deeper, go find the show notes at the Innovators website, theinnovators.co, or give me a shout across pretty much any social network at TKennedySA. I'm always open to feedback and ideas or even guest suggestions. So give me a shout. For now, that's me, Tom Kennedy. I'm out.